Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from the unceded ancestral territory of the Halkamilaman Squamish-speaking people who have been here since time immemorial, living, gathering, sharing stories and music and culture. And I'm very grateful to be able to do the same thing, my own version of that here.
And welcome to the Monday edition of Speak Up. Thanks to Jesse for that land acknowledgement. My name is Magnus Thiebold, and I'm your host for this hour of Speak Up. It's Monday, October the 20th. We have a bunch of interesting stories for you today. We have a report from our reporter, Danny Nesvadarani, about a new exhibition at the Museum of Vancouver, entitled Living with Long COVID. We also have a report from Northern BC, from our friends at CICK Radio in Smithers, about truth and reconciliation in Wet'suwet, which is a Wet'suwet'en community in Northern BC, about the future of Wet'suwet'en youth. So that'll be coming up in about 10 minutes or so, 10, 15 minutes. We have, of course, our regular segment, Gardening with Embark, and Peter Arich will be here at the end of the program with his topic of the day. So in the news these days, a couple stories, of course, here in BC. The BC government strike, a strike by the BC General Employees Union, which represents government workers, is continuing, although it is now heading towards a non-binding arbitration among the folks who will be, not arbitration, but rather non-binding mediation, and among the folks leading that mediation effort is Vince Reddy, who's been pretty much at the forefront of labor mediation efforts here in British Columbia. Just about every major dispute where they need a mediator to step in, he's the guy who is tapped for that. Government workers have been on strike for 7 weeks, which is quite a long strike. I'm sure it's difficult for those who are missing out on government services they're hoping to get to. I'm sure it's also very difficult for the striking workers themselves. That's a long time to be off the job and without a paycheck. Although it hasn't been, it's been rotating strikes and stuff like that for part of that period at any rate. But nevertheless, difficult for everyone involved. And so hopefully we'll see a resolution of that soon if that process goes well. In Palestine and Israel, the ceasefire that was brokered a couple weeks ago with the important intervention of Donald Trump is holding, but barely. On the weekend, there was what the Israelis are claiming was an incident in which their soldiers were shot at from a position, and the Israelis responded with airstrikes. A couple Israeli soldiers were killed, and almost over 40 Palestinians were killed. One of the things that's, I was reading about the war that was going on now, and is at least currently, hopefully it will stick for the moment, in a ceasefire, is that one of the Israeli sort of tactical approaches they've been doing is whatever else they do, they've been acting in a way to absolutely minimize casualties to their soldiers, which is why they've relied so heavily on airstrikes. It's an interesting choice to use airstrikes all the time. When you think how small the Palestinian, the Gaza territory is, I know with, modern weapons technology, aerial strikes can be remarkably precise. And perhaps you've seen a couple of the, some of the videos of strikes during the war, where an airstrike would precisely target the foundation of a tall tower block, residential tower block, and bring the whole thing down with a single strike. And that speaks to a lot of the precision with which they can land the bombs. At the same time, you know, one of the problems with airstrikes is, of course, you can only be as precise as the information you're working on. And it would appear a lot of times it's like, you know, we vaguely know there's some folks over there who are shooting at us, and they drop a lot of really big bombs. And inevitably there's a lot of going to be a lot of collateral damage. You may actually hit the fighters you're targeting, but it seems inevitable that, and it is, in fact, the fact that a lot of civilians, Palestinian civilians, are killed as well. You know, that number of over 40 killed represents mostly civilians and perhaps a few fighters. We didn't get any specific breakdown around what that might have looked like. But, you know, that's how we end up at a number of 65,000 casualties over the 2 years of this war. So hopefully, you know, that's a pretty big incident threatening the ceasefire from news reports. There's been significant intervention from both the White House and some of the other Arab states, which were supporters of the ceasefire, some of which have diplomatic relations with Israel, to pressure Israel to back off a bit on that. And hopefully it holds. I don't think we need to see a return to that killing. Efforts to end the war in Ukraine don't seem very hopeful to me. There's more talks between the White House and Russia, and then the White House and Zelensky of Ukraine. It seemed like some promises were made, or not made, but put out there for some increased weapons for Ukraine, and then that got pulled back. Really, that's not going to end until enough pressure is put on Russia to decide that they can't continue to continue that fight. You know, the basic problem is that, having been the aggressors and the invaders, they don't want to give up the territory they've seized. That would probably be pretty devastating to Putin and his hold on power to have started this war. All the lives lost of Russian soldiers. And they just pull back with nothing to gain. At the same time, Ukraine doesn't want to give up that sovereign territory of its own country. And until we can get some meeting of minds around that, it's really hard to see how this war is going to end without one side or the other, or perhaps both, being exhausted by the struggle, which in some ways doesn't seem so far off. In the meantime, the death and destruction continues. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're going to turn to a more local story. Our reporter, Danny Nesvadarani, went down to the Museum of Vancouver to speak with the curator of their new exhibition, Living with Long COVID.
Long COVID is a chronic medical condition that can consist of long-term and sometimes debilitating health issues as the result of a previous COVID-19 infection. The Museum of Vancouver's newest exhibit documents the everyday lives of people living with the condition, which, according to Statistics Canada, has now affected up to 1 in 9 Canadians. The exhibition is simply titled Living with Long COVID. For this exhibition, the Museum of Vancouver collaborated with researchers from Simon Fraser University's Faculty of Health Sciences and the Post-COVID-19 Interdisciplinary Clinical Care Network. The exhibition is primarily photography-based, with clusters of pictures and text provided by individuals living with long COVID who agreed to participate in the exhibition. To find out more about what the exhibition entailed, CJSF visited the Museum of Vancouver, where we were able to speak with Viviane Gosselin, the museum's curatorial lead. The first question we asked was, how did this exhibition and collaboration with SFU and the Clinical Care Network come to be?
Yeah, so excellent question. I will say that about half our exhibitions are proposed by people, partners, organizations outside the Museum of Vancouver. So, so we remember receiving a call from the Faculty of Health Sciences. So Rakib Tesfaye, who's a researcher there, approached us and just called me by saying, we work with long haulers, like so people living with long COVID, and doing research on the subject, and yet working with long haulers, they have told us that they feel invisible and would like to work on something public where they can express themselves and talk about this issue.
Next, we asked what the community response has been like so far for this exhibition on living with long COVID.
I will say for the long haulers, when they come here, and we met quite a few actually on opening day, and the general sense was they were pleased and happy to see themselves, even though they had not necessarily participated in and submitted photos for the project. They saw themselves, they felt heard, felt seen. So that was, that was very positive, because that was like one of the goals. The other goal was public awareness, right? Like destigmatize also the topic of long COVID, because it is misunderstood. People don't want to talk about it, or people feel judged because people are if they're talking about their symptoms, because there's not a lot of public education on the topic, these individuals feel that like the message they get is it's all in your head. You should try to do some yoga and a bit of exercise and you'll feel better.
We then asked what reactions they've received from individuals attending this exhibition that may not have been informed about long COVID beforehand.
There's, members of the public who, really hadn't planned to see an exhibition on long COVID, but just stumbled upon it. And we hear their comments, we do some tracking, and we can see people are surprised. Again, they're surprised by how little they knew about the condition. And also about the severity of the condition. Like the people who submitted, the vast majority are homebound, and their daily life has changed radically since getting COVID and living with the aftermath. And for people in the public health sector, I hope it's going to be a bit of a shakeup, right? Like when museums are partnering with research centers in making this more public, it means that it has to be felt in like daily practitioners, like physicians should know more about it. And also it is underdiagnosed, right? So if practitioners, health practitioners are more attuned, they may be able to refer their patients to specialists and support them in their healing or just kind of stabilizing their condition.
Afterwards, we asked Gosselin if she could go over some of the experiences depicted by those living with long COVID who submitted photos and text for this exhibition.
Part of this project, it's a photo-based project, it's about self-documentation and representation, and we said that part of the constraint, if you want, is document your day, and you can submit one and up to 6 images for that day, right? And so what I guess strikes me is when people are making reference to their life before, like everything that they were doing, and how, for example, now just going and walking a short walk around the corner, or just walking your dog for 15 minutes will completely like drain them. They have to go back to bed, right? So so that's struck me, is how their life has been, like, kind of their day-to-day life has been, like, the life, their universe has shrunk, if I can say it that way. But at the same time, we see great efforts to, figure out how to feel better, document their conditions, like a lot of kind of resourcefulness, and they know that they have this one appointment, and like prepping and researching and trying to understand best they can, like, so a lot of agency in that, like kind of trying to take some control over their condition. Looking at when I keep seeing like pets, like dogs and cats, I think provides great comfort to people who have them. Like it's something that they mention. It's like, I don't know what I would do if I didn't have, so and so. So I think that presence is, alleviates, if you want, some of the symptoms at times. But we also see these photos where someone made little stars out of like the mini pills and supplements they have to take. So a lot of people are showing their bottles of medication and prescribed and not prescribed, and creating their own, cocktail. And again, this is not filtered by a medicalized eye. This is very much the lived experience of long haulers. So we're not saying, hey, this is your treatment. Like for those who, this is them sharing what they're living. And I think whether you're from, you're a researcher or a scientist or just a member of the public, I think essentially we're asked to bear witness. And if people had not given any thought about this issue, this is the time to think about what that means. And given the high number of Canadians, so 1 out of 9 has experienced long COVID, thinking about our, our friends and neighbors, and like, guaranteed, Danny, that people who are living with long COVID. And so how can we help? Is there, how can we support these people?
Lastly, Viviane Gosling left us with what she hopes people are able to take away from the Living with Long COVID exhibition at the Museum of Vancouver.
I'd say come, and I'm in awe with the courage and honesty of long haulers. I, have deep admiration, and I'm humble. And I hope that people will come, because the more we get to understand the experience of these people, but also the context and the condition, because there's our partners at SFU had produced short texts about what is long COVID and what are the symptoms and the kind of impact it has. I think we have a responsibility to educate ourselves.
Once again, that was our conversation with Viviane Gosling, the curatorial lead for the Museum of Vancouver, on the Living with Long COVID exhibition, which is up until March 22nd, 2026. This has been Danny Nazvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks to Danny for that report. In a couple of minutes, we'll be up with a report about Truth and Reconciliation in Wet'suwet'en territories, particularly focused on youth. But first, This is a song from Canadian band Tops. They are currently number one on the National Campus Community Radio charts at earshotonline.com. This is Stars Come After You. Stars Come After You from their album By the Key, number one across Canada on campus community radio stations nationwide. You can check out more of what's getting a lot of attention on community radio at the Earshot charts. You can find those at earshot-online.com. Weekly charts go up every Wednesday. and monthly charts and others, and you can see what each station is doing as well. So check that out. Next story up comes from CICK Radio in Smithers, and they're following truth and reconciliation efforts in Wet'suwet'en territory, and how to carry culture and history forward to youth. Here's a report from Patty Hasen.
Now recognized as a National Day of Remembrance, September 30th has become a day to learn and to listen. I joined a procession of people in Wet'suwet'en to learn about the community's response to the drug overdose epidemic that has taken 54 lives in 7 years in the community. This is the voice of community councillor Warner Nazel on a chilly but bright day on Tuesday.
So what we plan on doing today is we have a march that we're going to do through the community. We're going to start here, work our way up. The subdivision is going to Jamie's place. We'll stop in the corner there. We'll do a prayer circle and maybe some songs. We'll go in front of the apartment buildings. We're going to do a prayer there as well. And we're going to ask Doug and Sherry to lead the prayers. We're going to have drummers here. We're then going to move over to Laura's house where Warren passed away. And we're going to erect a cross there. His family is carrying the cross. They'll carry the cross to that site. We're going to erect the cross, set it up there. We'll do a prayer and words of support for the family who were left behind.
On September 30th, a gathering of nearly 100 people marched together to bring awareness to the effects of colonization on the generations following residential school survivors and family members.
Because a lot of people were hurt and damaged by drug abuse in the last 10 years in a whole neighborhood. So we're going to offer prayers for people in that neighborhood to heal from that. Because often, one of the big things that we struggle with in our community is paralysis from trauma. When we lose somebody from drug abuse, we almost don't know what to do. We're in shock. So this march today is to shake that shock off so we're not standing there in shock all the time because of the losses that we've experienced. We want to begin doing something. We can't stand here and be in shock our whole life. At some point, we have to get moving. We have to pray. We have to do activities to help the healing happen in our community. All of our families have struggled too long. Many of us, the people who passed away through the community, we're going to recognize them, and we're going to offer healing to everybody who struggles with this.
Warner Nazel led the march and, with a committee, organized the sites that we would visit. The people walking and driving were elders, community counselors, chiefs, families who have lost loved ones to overdose or to drug-related deaths, children, aunties, uncles, and neighbors.
One of the reasons why we picked today to do the walk to address the drug crisis on Truth and Reconciliation Day is because I'm a frontline worker. I work in Hazleton, and I help a lot of people who are struggling with drug abuse and alcohol abuse. And every time I talk with my clients, I try and get to the root of the problem. Where did it all start? And often they'll talk about traumas that they've experienced in their life. Could be like really heavy traumas. They've experienced that in their lives. And the people who caused that trauma on them, I ask them to name them. And I then ask them, where did they get that trauma from? Because it's not something that comes natural. They have to mention the next person that's in line. They said, oh, I had a grandpa or I had a great uncle who was really mean all the time. And he used to do stuff. My family always talked about it. Okay, where do you think he got it from? And it always goes back to Indian residential schools. Everybody who suffers from trauma in their communities, from drug abuse, the other kinds of trauma that we all know about, that all started from Indian residential schools. So we connected the two dots. The drug crisis that we're struggling with here today is as a result of what happened to our children in Indian residential schools. Some of those children survived, and they brought back trauma. They brought back trauma that they learned. And they passed it down generation to generation. And that trauma is still very much alive in our community. So what we want to do is shine a light on a dark space, on a shadow that sits right over top of our community. We want to shine a bright light on that and expose it for what it is and learn to heal from it. So this is one of the big first steps that we want to do to address that. So I want to again thank everybody for coming out and joining on us and giving yourself an opportunity to heal, because we're all going to have an opportunity to heal today. Thank you.
Though the seriousness of the day was prevalent in the moments where we stopped and listened, children continued to play, and people held each other in acts of love and support. People would come out of their houses to wave and smile at us as we walked by, and the feeling of how close the community of Whitsett is what permeated the day. We walked through the streets of Whitsett in awareness, and as Chief Elgin, Pastor Doug, Sherry Warner, and other speakers professed, this is for the future of Whitsett's children. That is the sound of a metal cross being hammered by many people into the ground, where Warren Morris died on the front lawn of his aunt's house last year. He was 35 years old. Family was encircled by the community to mourn and hopefully to begin healing together.
Love you, Warren.
Wish for Ruby in the family.
So the objective for this cross is for families to have a place to come and pray. You can work on making necklaces, you can come up with flowers, whatever it is you want. You can plant a little garden around it, but it's a place where the community, the neighborhood here, the family have a chance to come and let things go. We heard some of the family cry earlier and we got here, and it's so important. We have to heal from this. If that healing requires us to cry, if it requires us to talk about really hard things, then that's what we should be doing to heal. So this place is the first one that we're recognizing now. We want to do many marches in the future to recognize other places, because a lot of people pass away in this community from drug abuse and the drug crisis and their addictions. And we want to recognize them as well. So Warren is one of the precious memories that we have. A lot of people are impacted by his loss. I'm impacted by his loss. I was really good friends with his late dad. So I think it's such an important thing to have a place where we can come and pray, where we can offer prayers, to comfort Laura, because her nephew passed away in her yard. He was on his way home to see his mom, and he only made it this far. So it's a place where we can offer prayers for the whole family. There's a lot of people that Warren left behind. His good friends. He has so many good friends. We're all left behind. So it's a place, I think it's important to recognize the fact that we have a beautiful opportunity to just offer prayers now. Come by and drop some flowers off. Even just come by and lay some medicine down or some tobacco down. And just say a few words for the family. The energy that comes from prayers is powerful. A lot of us know just how powerful that is. It's incredibly powerful. So if we can do that for the family and come here and offer prayers once in a while, even if you're coming back from a walk or coming back for a ride, pull over. Come over and just offer prayers. Say some prayers for the neighborhood. There's lots of kids that live here. Let's pray for their safety. Let's pray for the elders who are left behind, puzzled, because we're not supposed to be burying our young. But here we are.
Masai to Warner Nizel, Matt Anderson, the families of Warren Morris and Draper Poirier, and to Charmaine Nicole for making this recording possible. And Masai to the community of Whitsett for doing the work to face the challenges in their community and ensuring a safe and healthy future for their next generation.
Tune in to Intravenous on Wednesdays from 10 to 11 a.m. for music and talk radio about all things all genders. Discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through an intersectional feminist lens, our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony. Intravenous, every Wednesday morning from 10 to 11, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.
Attention, women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting on your journey, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology is here to support you every step of the way. From mentorship programs to networking and skill-building events, we've got the tools and resources you need to succeed and thrive in STEM. Visit squist.ca to learn more. That's SCWIST.ca. We can't wait to connect with you.
Just about time for Gardening with Embark. But before we get to there, Peter R.H. is here. What are you going to be talking about in about 15 minutes?
I'm going to be talking about the situation whereby mainland China told Canada if they drop all the tariffs towards them, they would supposedly drop all the tariffs. One is about the canola oil, the canola farmers. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that the canola oil is about half of it's $43 billion and 206 jobs, but the
206
206,000.
Okay,
and the Canadian auto sector is worth $84 billion, and so what they kind of feel is that they're sort of going towards the auto sector, but I'll be talking more about that a bit.
Okay, we'll be up at that at about 10:50, 13 or 14 minutes from now. But first, it's time for Gardening with Embark.
It's time now for Gardening with Embark. Joining me in the studio is Pablo Vimas, Gardens Manager for Embark Sustainability and our Gardens Expert. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So I think we're in week 42 now.
Correct.
Getting very close to the end of the season.
Very close indeed.
And you were noting that already we're seeing some of the cold weather, even a little early.
Yes. So we had quite a good spell of rain a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, the temperature has dropped. And we, down the mountain, we have seen some areas with some icicles. So the water that was in the soil now is all frost. So that really tells us that, yeah, the temperature has dropped in order for the water to convert into ice.
And we're in week 42. Typically, we talk a lot about the different weeks because it's a calendar that helps folks plan their gardening, when to do stuff, when to prepare stuff, when to start, when to finish, when to harvest.
Yes.
You can really use this week numbers, you know, throughout the year to sort of keep yourself on track and know what you need to be looking forward to. One of the numbers you've mentioned a number of times, I think it's week 44 or week 45.
Yes.
Which is when we expect the frost to come. But we're seeing a little bit, maybe a little early.
Maybe a bit early. So, yeah. So we work on weeks, or I work on weeks, and we encourage everybody to work on weeks because we can relate those weeks with civic festivities, town festivities, cultural festivities.
And the school year.
The school year, indeed. And so, and it's easier for us to remember, oh, there is that deadline coming up. Yeah. So for us now is the first frost of the year, and we need to be ready for that. And it's week 45, so around November the 11th, everybody remembers TV, radio, news everywhere is November the 11th. And either a week before or a week after, the first frost will be there. So that is, so having a deadline helps us to work towards that and plan and prepare for that. So we don't get like, oh, suddenly, oh, the frost is here and I haven't prepared.
Yeah. And so just a quick question. So the bit of ice, the bit of frost you saw on the soil, is that different than what we're expecting in a couple of weeks? Because eventually you get to the point where the frost is all over the plants themselves and
the
leaves.
Yes. So at the moment, no. At the moment, it's just a ground level. So it means that the soil is cold now.
Yeah.
So if we are planting seeds, most of the seeds won't germinate because it's too cold. The temperature might have dropped for a few hours. Mm-hmm. But when we have the first frost, we see the frost on top of the soil, on top of the grass, on top of the leaves, and it lasts for quite a few hours, that frost. So, so that is, not yet, we are not at that stage, but at one point the temperature has dropped overnight.
Right.
The other thing that we keep in mind is that when the temperature dips below 10 Celsius, that is when the plants stop growing.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no more development of the plants. The plants kind of start now, frost is coming, and their biology start moving the water from the cells and replacing with glycol, which is antifreeze. So the hardy plants like cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, these are the brassicas, they have that ability to create glycol. There's a bit of more sugar in, in the cells, so to prevent the frost. On the contrary, lettuce don't have that.
Right.
So a first light frost, the lettuce or the cells of the lettuce will freeze because of the water, explode, and the plant is done.
Yeah.
The leaves done. So that's why we can see that during cold winters, Kelly just standing there, looking gorgeous, and say, throw me anything else because I'm just standing here. And it's because it has this capacity to withstand the cold weather.
But for things like the lettuce, you need to get that in before that happens.
Before that happens. And then we have a small herbs like arugula, can stand a bit of cold weather. And leeks, we plan for having them over the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to our week, so when we started, this was on week 9, very early in April. And then we've been telling, week 9, remember week May, the long weekend of May 20, week 20 is when we start all our summer crops. Mm-hmm. Then we were saying, week 26, the school ends, and we have to start seeding all our vegetables for the fall. So when we have our, and then week 36 comes after summer break, and then we are like, we need now to make sure that we plant everything that we want from seeds for the fall and winter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the reason we have all this in weeks. And so if we have started in May, I'm sorry, in April, early in the season, and just planning for the over winter, we can start sowing leeks, but from seeds, because it really is very slow to germinate those seeds.
Yeah.
And the same with the Walla Walla onions, parsnips and scallions. So those take time to grow, so that we start way early in the season in order to plan for the overwintering. May and June, as we mentioned, matching with the end of the school year, and then we can start our kale, our Savoy cabbages, our Swiss chard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Swiss chard very much loves a bit of cold, but once we reach the end of December, kind of all the leaves die. But we have a bit of the fall, at least with that. And in August, we are just coming back to school at mid of August, and then we start with our overwinter onions and spinach, rutabaga, Russian kale. So everything has to be planned. So at this time, in 2 more weeks, our plants will be in a teenager stage. That is how, if we compare it with our life stage of humans, the kale will be in a teenager stage. So just above ground, big enough to stand the cold winter coming, But because it won't grow, it's lower than 10 degrees. Mm-hmm. And until March next spring, when the temperature suddenly will increase and the plants will just have a boom, growing very fast.
Right. And so this is how you get your very first crops of the spring. It's what you've done last year.
Correct. So we are now planning in order to have our first crops in the spring. So if you just new to gardening, you will say, what I'm planning, and what I'm planting in the spring, so you will have to wait until April.
Yeah.
To start something, because we know that by April we don't have any frost. But those who have been gardening 2 or 3 years, they will say, this is the time to put, because, you are thinking in April what to plant, I'm already harvesting. And my gardening season has started very quick.
And then, of course, that allows you to really extend, you're starting earlier and getting more produce throughout the year, right?
Correct, yeah. So that's what we call gardening year-round. And then this time we call extending the gardening season by building hoop houses, mulching the soil. So that's why we extend.
So part of this process is the mulching as well, which you just...
Yeah, last week we chat about the mulching. And the mulching is important that... So this week is not raining, which is great. Mm-hmm. And so we mulch the soil, which is covering the soil with a layer of any material. And we use leaves because it's easy and available. And in order to cover the soil when it still is warm. Mm-hmm. The soil still is warm. Because later in December, when the soil is too cold, if you cover, the cold kind of stays in there.
Right.
Yeah, it stays there. So that's what we do now before the fall, before the cold temperature arrives, and before the excessive rain arrives. So we just cover all that. Mm-hmm. And so over the winter, all these leaves will decompose. All these leaves become a habitat for all the living things in the soil, bacteria, fungi, and invertebrates, mainly earworms.
Right.
Because if you say, I'm an earworm, and my home, everything around me becomes all frost and cold, you certainly will move to an area where it's warmer.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the layer of the mulch layer, which is lots of leaves and little cracks in there. And there is food, good environment to overwinter. So very much we now start in a season with the temperature drops, mm-hmm. the air temperature. So we had to make a difference in here, which is the air temperature and the soil temperature.
Yeah.
They are two different. Well, the air temperature during the summer is high. The soil temperature will be a bit lower.
Mm-hmm.
But here in when transition over winter, the kind of the switch.
Right.
The soil becomes colder than the air. So that's why when we can put seeds, but because it's too cold, nothing germinate.
Do you mean the air is colder than the soil?
The soil is colder than the air over the winter.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and over the summer, the air will be too hot and the soil will be cooler.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so we have this switch.
Yeah.
So when we talk about frost, we are talking about the air temperature, not the soil temperature, the air temperature. And so when the temperature drops from the air, we can have a light freeze.
Mm-hmm.
So -2, it drops to -2 from 0 to -2, very light, enough to kill the lettuces, unfortunately. But the cabbage and cauliflower, they are doing okay, and kale is just. Then we have a moderate freeze, which goes from -2 to -4.
Yeah.
So yeah, -4, -6 degrees, we start feeling, we are just using toques, keeping warm, looking for gloves, and the plants, some of them will just not stand that. So arugula, their peas will start feeling that, and kale and broccoli still happily. And then we have the severe frost, which is below 4-5 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, this temperature will stay... I would say 6-7 hours.
Yeah,
cold temperature.
Right.
So it's enough for plants to be killed. But the kale is still happy. Parsley as well, doesn't mind if we have snow. But once we go -15, which usually happens here in Vancouver around mid-February,
right?
January is kind of mild, nice, sunny. We get this high spirit, like, oh, it's sunny, it's high. Let's be in the garden. Let's go start planting. But we forget that by mid-February, we have a dump of snow.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have enough for a week that we have -10 degrees.
Yeah.
All our plants will be, even the kale sometimes suffers that. Yeah.
Right.
So if with the air temperature drops like that in during the winter, we will have the salt temperature even colder. So that's why we say don't work on the salt. No need to work.
Yep.
Everything will be frozen. Everything will be hard. And even holding the soil with your bare hands is you don't want to do that.
But then are those plants gonna when things warm up starting in March, then they're gonna come back and
they will come back and the soil will slowly be warming up and the plants come back to life and they will start producing.
So whatever you do, don't dig them all out.
No. There's other things that because of the soil gets too cold over the winter, that's how as well the type of garden bed, the material that you're using for your garden bed is very important.
Yeah.
So that's why we advise to use wood because the wood warms up slowly, cools off slowly. It's quite thermal. However, now we are moved to aluminium garden beds.
Yeah.
And aluminium, it really gets hot very quick and gets cold very quick, so loses the temperature very easy, gains and loses temperature very easy. So now we are going to see how it works over this winter. let's see how long it takes for the soil to warm up. Hopefully the aluminium allows to the soil to warm up quickly, but I think as well overnight it will get cold very quickly. Right. So it will be this shock of soil temperature.
Right. All right, so our winter garden, you actually need to have it in by now.
Yes.
But, thinking for next year, you've got these deadlines or these time frames in April for a certain chunk of plants, and then May and June, sort of midsummer there, and then again in August to get these plants in.
Correct,
And then you're going to see your bounty come March. While everyone else is looking at little shoots and waiting for seeds to germinate, you're going to be
harvesting. And enjoying the garden already.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Pablo.
A pleasure to be here.
Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society and our gardens expert. How do people find out more about Embark?
Embark Sustainability can be found through our social media channels at Embark Sustainability, or you can visit our website, embarksustainability.org, or come to talk to us here at the Student Union. We're in the room 1310. We are all working here. Happy to see you and talk to you. And if you're interested, we have a gardening cohort running 4 times a year. So the next will be next spring.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Pablo.
See you. Bye-bye.
See you next week.
See you.
Democracy Now! Will be up at the top of the hour at 11 o'clock. But before we get there, Peter, all right, you want to talk about trade?
Yes. Now, recently, mainland China has made the proposal that if Canada drops all the tariffs against mainland China, including the type of electric automobile, that they will not have any tariffs against us.
Right.
Now, why there's sort of a resistance to this is that one of the things is the canola oil, which goes to.
One of the things China is tariffing is.
Is there
agricultural products like canola oil?
And so canola is to the Canadian economy is $43 billion, 206,000 jobs. The Canadian auto sector is worth $84 billion. Mm-hmm. Now, here's a few other facts about the situation. Supposedly, and this was, it's a Dr. Tom Copper, a professor of business strategy over at Memorial University.
Yeah.
He contends that just 5% tariffs moves operations to the U.S. And he said manufacturer of autos should focus on EVs, batteries, critical minerals, et cetera, not cheap compasses. Is this a type of car?
Compass, yeah.
Yeah, compass, okay. An investment in what will be here in 15 or 20 years. Now, there's some other deal where supposedly the United States is investing in the mining in Canada of these rare metals, which I think is a bad idea. We should not.
We should not let the Americans in on that?
No, I'm going to say what I think is, I think so, yeah. The other thing is that I think we should, I think there's a problem with those vehicles from mainland China, but they contend that they can get information on people. Have you heard anything about this, Magnus?
Well, not specifically, but people worry about a lot of Chinese IT products and the idea of backdoors. And I mean, that's part of the reason that TikTok was sort of held up and in the States, and ultimately there was a forced sort of sale to sell part of TikTok to American investors because of the concerns about information gathering on the part of the company, and then that information would be passed to the Chinese government.
Anyway, so that be as it may, maybe we can block those things. I think we should have no tariffs to mainland China. Not that I like mainland China, but we're in a certain situation right now. You're not going to, like, no matter what you do to a PGSH, they will do the absolute worst. Mm-hmm. That's been proven. Why not just do what we want to do and say, well, you're going to do the worst anyway? And now, Harold Lutnick told a business audience, I don't know.
And he's the Secretary of Treasury Secretary?
Or Commerce.
Commerce Secretary for the U.S. government.
No,
for the Trump administration.
I don't know whether this is when Canada, United States, but that's what he said. Canada eventually won't make cars and should think about where else it can create jobs and prosperity. So they want to destroy anyway. So
yes, I think one of the concerns is that already the car industry, the auto industry, is kind of the heart of the U.S. or the Ontario manufacturing sector, one of the biggest and most important sectors, and historically a very successful one. You know, it's under pressure from the U.S. tariffs. You know, one of the things that was in the news just in last week was plans to build a Jeep vehicle in Ontario got moved down to a plant in the States.
Yes.
The Chinese EVs are, I don't know all the details, but apparently they're very cheap. And if they were allowed in tariff-free, they would completely undercut the North American market.
Well, they wanted to destroy our auto sector. So bring them into Canada, and they've already destroyed us. The other thing is that about as far as Howard Lutnick goes, he prior to you becoming the position, Secretary of Commerce or whatever it is, you either go to the House of Representatives or the Senate, and you meet up, and people ask you questions. And it's on YouTube somewhere where someone asks, do you understand that the auto sector between Canada and the United States are very interconnected? And he says, yes, I do. So he's a liar. Because he said to that person that he would be respecting that. And I think if he can find a legal way of saying, look, you lied, we should get some other person appointed through some legal channel, of international law or whatever.
Yeah.
Because get somebody else, because you lied. That's what you did. Whether this is right or wrong, I think we should have an embargo. We should not sell aluminum to the United States at all. And Brazil has the compound, which has you have to smelt it.
Yeah.
And I would suggest maybe this that they have an embargo of their bauxite.
Yeah.
And basically, we import the Brazilian bauxite to Quebec. We got one here in province of British Columbia, Kitimat, but it's mainly Quebec, and we sell that to the rest of the world, make some sort of deal. Whether that's an entirely feasible concept, I presented to the radio ship.
Yeah, well, one of the weird things about the tariffs, U.S. tariffs on aluminum, is they don't produce enough aluminum for themselves, and they can't really produce enough aluminum for themselves, because part of the process of creating aluminum, smelting aluminum, requires a great deal of electricity, which is why, for instance, there's a smelter up in Kitimat, because they built a dam specifically to generate electricity for that plant, and now they have the dam in it. And the same thing in Quebec. They have ample, cheap hydroelectric energy, which they can then use to, basically, they don't have that option in the U.S. to do that. So it's weird. But the whole trade thing is pretty complicated. We don't have time to dig more into it now, because we're running out of time.
Of it, I think. I did, at least.
Yep, you absolutely did. All right. Thank you for listening to Speak Up this hour. Speak Up airs every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday at 10 o'clock on CJSF. Daniel will be back on the radio tomorrow at 10 a.m. with a fresh agenda of stories and interviews, so stick around for that. Democracy Now! Is coming up right away. Lots more great programming up here on CJSF all throughout the day, including Wandering Rhythms and Typically Tuesday.